suffering is wrong. Suffering is not as things should be. And kind of the glory of that is, well, it points to the fact that things should be otherwise. And why do we have that idea? Why do we have that collective sense that things should be different? Is it because there's something of God speaking in that about how he wants our world to be, how things could be?
So I've been fascinated for some time by one of the great tensions of our shared humanity, our propensity to experience at one and the same time both great love and great suffering, where we can find ourselves both holy and broken, hurting and healed. As a pastor, I've seen people face the worst moments of life and yet in them discover the greatest moments of their humanity, where suffering and struggle and injustice birth something profoundly honest and real and hopeful. If you're anything like me, I yearn to hear stories of women and men from around the world who have found themselves wrestling with God and as a result have walked away with a beautiful limp. I'm Andrew Gardner, and this is A Broken Hallelujah. Here we are, my friends, episode 8. And man, episode 7. You guys just loved that episode. I had so many DMs, so many emails from people around the world who just really connected to Linda Pezzavento's story and just her journey with her eldest child going through gender dysphoria and transgender. And Linda's perspective on that, I know, was deeply helpful for many of you. And that just fills me with such joy that this podcast can be an important part of your conversations, important part of your journey in faith, and can really help to connect somebody's story to your story and to be a benefit and help to you. So that's really why we do A Broken Hallelujah. And I just was so grateful to see how that particular episode helped and connected with so many of you. Today, I get to have a conversation with a really good friend of mine, someone that I've known for most of my kind of life. Her name's Madeline Miller. She's training to be a priest in the UK, and she's got a fascinating story really around the concepts of grief. Her father, as you'll hear in the interview, passed away a few years ago with ALS or motor neurons disease. And I don't know if you've ever had anybody in your life with that disease, but it's incredibly difficult. And it's incredibly hard to see somebody who was fully able-bodied to go through that process and to really struggle in that. So you'll hear a little bit more about Madeline's story and how she went through that. But she has these incredible reflections on grief and particularly on beauty. Scripture talks about how God brings us a crown of beauty for ashes, that he's going to do that in us. And that's really been Madeline's journey and her story. And as an artist herself, I think her reflections around beauty will be really encouraging to you. So that's all coming up in this episode. I can't wait for you to hear that and get into that. As always, you can reach out to us at A Broken Hallelujah by sending us an email, which you can do so through contact@abrokenhallelujah.com, and that'll be really great to hear from you, hear your comments, and any suggestions that you have of people that we can be speaking to who carry a story of brokenness or pain or hurt or trauma and are looking for God in the midst of that. But without further ado, I can't wait for you to hear this. Here's my interview with Madeline Miller. Well, Madeline, we're so grateful to have you on A Broken Hallelujah. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So why don't we just start with a general overview about yourself, who you are, where you live, and I guess what you're doing right now.
So my name is Madeline. I live in West London. I've been here about 10 years, and I have two small children, a two-year-old and a six-year-old as of yesterday. And what am I doing? I am training to be a priest. I'm in the second year of three training to be a priest. My background is mainly teaching. I've been an English philosophy and theology teacher and a film teacher, actually. So some connection with some of your earlier interviewees. And And that's what I do. That's what I'm doing here in London, is working for the church, studying, taking care of a home and a family. Yeah.
And you and I, obviously, we go way back. Our families go way back. You lived in Hong Kong for many years, grew up in Hong Kong, I guess, largely. Tell us a little bit about your family background and what growing up was like in Asia for you.
Yeah, so as I say, I moved to London 10 years ago because of my husband's work, but actually over half of my life has been in Hong Kong. So 22 years of my life is living in Hong Kong. Mm. Still feel very connected with the area. I've still got, strong connections, friends and family there. And my heart, really tugs for being there. So that's where I grew up. My family moved there when I was 2 years old. So I have no kind of memory of growing up anywhere else, of course. Did all my schooling there and then moved to the UK for university. And then after a few years working in the UK, went back to Hong Kong. I imported a husband from Oxfordshire as well. He came with me at that point.
Yeah.
And so growing up in Hong Kong in the, I guess, the 90s, 80s, 90s, it was a really interesting time. And my family actually have a long history in the region. My dad also grew up in Hong Kong. His father was a colonel with the army and stationed in Hong Kong for a time. And then my mum also had a kind of parallel life over in Singapore. So, it's an interesting pattern, the journey of my family history in Asia.
Yeah. So you grew up in a Christian home I guess had a pretty, I don't know if standard's the right word. You can tell me whether it was standard or not, but you were raised, I guess, within a faith environment. Tell me a little bit about your experience of that as a child into your teenage years, and then I guess your own faith development.
Yeah, my family, I grew up in a Christian home, a very strong faith, I would say, not religion. My parents met and married when they were very young, and their kind of relationship with Jesus is extremely important in that narrative of their love for one another. And so they had children very early. And so I guess my brother and I'm the eldest of four, and there's a 6.5 year difference between me and the youngest two, who are twins. But me and my brother James are actually only 16 months apart, so we're quite close in age and experience. And so my brother James and I kind of wrapped up in that experience for them. You know, their marriage, their love for one another, their passion for Jesus is all very real in our household.
Right.
I would say it was real. It was lived. We grew up reading Bible stories. I grew up believing in the power of prayer to heal, the power of prayer. It was all very, very kind of, I would say, a real and living faith in our home.
Right.
When I was about, I guess, you know, this kind of fairly typical journey of being about 13 was when I had those moments of questioning faith for myself, wanting to emerge from a kind of childhood faith into a grown faith. Mm-hmm. But I should probably say that actually, even before 13, I feel like I've always known God and always had a profound kind of knowledge of Him and His love. And I would say I attribute that entirely to my parents and how they brought us up as praying, believing Christians in the home. But when I was 7, for example, I had a recurring kidney condition, which meant for quite gory results, I guess, for a 7-year-old.
Yes.
And I was taken to the doctor a few times. The condition recurred a few times. And the doctor said to me, and you should never say this to a 7-year-old, anyone who's listening, if this happens again, we're going to have to operate. Mm-hmm. My 7-year-old head was like, no way. So, of course, what did I do the next time it happened? I didn't tell anybody because I didn't want surgery.
Right.
I'm no fool. So there I am in the toilets of my primary school dealing with what has been happening. Mm-hmm. And just felt really sure of God's power. And I prayed in the name of Jesus over myself that this condition would go away and never come back. And it went away and has never come back.
Wow.
So that was kind of, by 7 years old, somehow that was integrated into my faith, my life experience, to the point where I had that faith to pray and saw prayers answered.
You know, what's really interesting is I'm hearing much of this for the first time, even though I've known you for years, and I'm grateful to hear these stories, and thank you for sharing them. I'm sitting here thinking, like, so there's this real tangible encounter type relationship, almost like a childlike faith type relationship. It's like, I prayed, it happens. You know, I asked for this, you know, God came through. And I'm sure that your faith journey, well, I guess my question would be, you know, has that always been your faith journey? Has that, from that point onwards, even to this day, do you feel like you've got a very simplistic kind of faith in that way? Or have you found that your faith has changed and developed? Questions arose, things happened. What has the journey kind of been like since those first kind of initial major encounters?
Yeah, it's interesting, because what I find difficult to separate out is my personal faith journey and the Christian culture and context, and how much influence that one thing had over the other thing, if you know
right.
what I mean.
Sure.
Because I feel like I would say that I agree that my faith has always, I feel like God has blessed me with faith, is what I would say. Mm-hmm. I feel like faith is something that has been given to me. I don't feel like I've generated it at all.
Right.
And when I've come to really difficult sticking points, I wonder how much of that is to do with the cultural context of church versus my actual relationship with God, if you know what I mean.
That's fascinating.
I don't know if I've made myself very clear there. But
yeah, yeah. So, no, I get that, yeah. And I think that really kind of brings us to, I guess, one of the core things that I wanted to talk to you today about, and that was, you know, your journey with your father and his journey through ALS. Obviously the ultimate reality of him passing away from that disease. I'm just really grateful up front that you're willing to even share that story, you know, with our community, because, you know, I think journeying with the loss of, a parent, you know, is a difficult thing just in and of itself. But I think in the way that obviously that journey was for your father, I'm sure there were some real, challenges in that for you, and then that impact on your faith. So I guess I just want to kind of open up that side of this conversation, and maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about, you know, what happened to your father, I guess the development of the disease, when you guys first became aware of it, and kind of what that did for you as a family and what kind of changes came upon you guys at that point.
Yeah, certainly. It's actually such a privilege to be able to talk about it, because we're not really permitted to have these conversations in kind of everyday life, are we? People don't ask you about these things, but for me, certainly, all I want to do is talk about it. So my dad was, yeah, he is the big man in my life. He was a tall, elegant, handsome man, very successful, wonderful musician, strong, silent type. And at the time of his diagnosis, he was a director of a school of 4,000 students in Singapore.
Mm.
He'd had a great career. He's a teacher. He was a teacher. He moved into kind of management stuff. So a really, you know, really illustrious career, really righteous man, you know, godly, faithful, generous,
mm-hmm.
great guy. So yeah, he was certainly the big man in my life and kind of the linchpin of the family, really. So he provided quite a lot of stability for us and things like that, but also a lifestyle.
Right,
you know,
right.
which is an interesting point to talk about, really, is the whole kind of expat luxury lifestyle that he also provided for the family. Anyway, so he died at the age of 61. of ALS, or motor neuron disease, as we call it in the UK. And that was 16 months after he had been diagnosed with the condition. So quite a short period of illness.
Right.
However, I do remember noticing something strange about him at my grandmother's funeral. So my grandmother, I think it was 2012. It must have been 2012. She died. That was his mother. And he had been flying, from East Asia over to the UK where she lived quite frequently. So it'd be big, long flights. And then she died. And he kind of held it all together. He's the middle son and mm-hmm. of three. And I remember he had to play at her funeral. He had to play the guitar. It was a request that Mary, is what we called her, had made. So he did, as the faithful son, he was playing. And I supported him by singing with him. And I remember noticing his leg shaking like uncontrollably as he was playing. Mm. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. He's nervous because... Mm. If anybody else performs, you'll know that your nerves kind of manifest in different ways. And I've certainly had a leg shake experience when I've performed. Yeah. And so I thought, oh my goodness, that's so interesting. I felt sorry for him because, this was his mother's funeral and he was doing what he had been asked to do. And yet there was an emotional cost to that.
Right.
And I was seeing that. Anyway, so I remember that leg shake. And then for the months that followed, he began to limp. And I was living in the UK by this point, so I only saw them every few months. And the next time I saw him, I said, Dad, what's going on with your leg? And him being the strong silent type, well, it's nothing. Anyway, so I thought, okay. He had some other conditions, which I thought maybe it's a little bit of that, a touch of something in the foot and it will go away, whatever it is. Anyway, it didn't. And the condition kind of ALS, it affects your nerves in the kind of the long nerves first. So arms and legs.
Right.
And it just progressed to the point where he couldn't walk normally or use his hands, and he was seeking a diagnosis in Singapore, but I think people were afraid to kind of tell him what it was, although I expect many medical professionals suspected. So he actually came over to London and came to a hospital here and brought all his x-rays and test results and things like that, and saw an expert here in London, and she diagnosed him with motor neuron disease, and he paid her a check of £700 for that privilege. I thought that was really odd, because he was a private client, and there he was signing this quite massive check for a death sentence, really.
Yeah. ALS really is such a brutal disease, if I can use that word, in the sense that it, from my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but you basically lose control of your body, essentially, but your mind stays as active as it has ever been. So it's not a mental health issue. There doesn't seem to be a deterioration in the brain, but there's a deterioration in the connection of the brain, I guess, to the body. Is that a correct understanding of the disease?
That's exactly right. Yes, that's exactly right. So quite simply, your body stops responding to what you want it to do from the extremities towards the middle of your body. So you'll notice people with ALS can't use fingers. And this was a huge tragedy for my dad, who was, as you'll know, a guitar player.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So for him to kind of realize that he could no longer play guitar, and that must have been one of the earliest symptoms for him, was terrible. And you'll know, as I say, he was a tall and elegant man, he very well dressed, so his physical presence was always significant.
Yes.
So to see that kind of deteriorate is awful. It's a horrible, horrible condition, horrible disease, because, as you say, Andrew, it's your mind is as sharp as ever. So it's like your body, which has always been, helping you through life mm-hmm. now becomes the prison.
And I had the privilege of visiting your father a couple of times when he was in Singapore, and I guess in the last sort of 6 months of his life, probably. And I remember, you know, feeling, I think, a lot of the emotions that you must have felt, and obviously you felt them at a level that I didn't, but, you know, just knowing your dad really well, seeing, you know, that, you know, at that point, I think it was even difficult for him to move his head, and obviously to talk, you know, and it just sort of felt, I just, you know, I remember coming out of that experience going, yeah, it must feel like he's trapped inside of this body that's kind of given up on him. As his daughter, you know, and the way you described him as being, you know, this such important male figure in your life, what was that like for you? What was that journey of seeing your father deteriorate in that way? What was that like, and how did you process that?
It was interesting for me because, as I say, I was living in a different country. So I saw him every few months or over the, you know, physically. And so the difference was profound. Every time that I saw him, it was a significant deterioration and completely tragic, really, completely tragic. And for somebody, I think I've expressed that he was so... his physical presence was significant. You know, he was so to see him unable to do things, to see him using a club hand to spoon food out of a bowl because he could no longer use forks and knives or plates, you know, using this club hand. Completely tragic, really. And I went to his office because he insisted on working for a really long time, and he would always take extra care to dress really well. You know, he needed assistance to dress, but he would always make sure that he dressed really well. And there he was in his office, and I just saw him struggling to move around, and yet he was about to go and chair a meeting. So it's this very, very difficult experience for those around the person who's ill, really, because you want to give them the dignity that they obviously want, and yet your heart is really pulled because you see the struggle. The struggle is completely visible and tangible, and yet trying to kind of interact with them on a professional level or a kind of, you know, personal level, and yet what do we do about the fact that he's nearly choking on his lunch or can't maneuver around a chair to get to the right place, you know, those kinds of things. It becomes a very, it's challenging.
I want to ask you, you know, earlier you explained that so much of the sort of foundations of your own faith journey was found in this idea of, I guess, power encounters with God, you know, speaking in tongues, you know, your own personal experience of healing through prayer. And I know that the faith community that we both grew up in, you know, was one in which, you know, healings and the expectation of healing and prayer was there. What was that journey like here with your dad? Did you find that that was a space that you naturally moved into? Tell me a little bit about how you approached your prayer life with him. Were you expecting God to heal him? Was that part of your focus, or did you sense that the Holy Spirit was moving in a different way at that time?
It's so interesting to reflect on because there are so many different factors involved, really. And as I certainly prayed, and I prayed for healing because I believe that was the right thing to do. Like it says in Daniel, when they're about to go into the furnace, you know, our God is able to do this. But even if he doesn't, it doesn't mean he's not there. And right. that was the principle that I continue to live by, really, mm-hmm. and felt the kind of sovereignty of God in it. I certainly prayed for healing and things. However, I think it's all right to admit this. I felt within myself he would not be healed. And And I don't know if that's unfair to say, but for me, that was, I felt the Lord's kindness for me was just saying, prepare yourself, because he's not going to be healed. So that's what I felt. I kept that to myself. I didn't think that was helpful to share with anyone else. but prayed for healing. But more than that, I prayed for comfort, and I prayed for comfort for my dad, who must be terrified. And I prayed for comfort for those around him, and peace. And I know more than anything, my dad wanted physical healing. I know he wanted that more than anything to be healed. I mean, yeah, I think for any man of any man, particularly of his generation, to see his body deteriorate like that was just terrible because of the lack of dignity involved.
Right. Yes.
But we had some powerful prayer times together. I remember reading the chapter from Ezekiel where he's called to prophesy to the dry bones. Son of man, will these bones live? And we had a prayer time there, and I really felt the presence of God. I really felt the power of God there. We had this amazing time of worship, and yet he was not healed. And yeah, here we are. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting. I just would add that in amongst all of that, we also were in a particular Christian culture over in Singapore, which was very much about, what sin do we need to rebuke or cast off? Are there curses? All of that kind of thing, which I think, I don't know how helpful it was to have that rhetoric in the background as well. Anyway, so it's about kind of, what do we resist? What do we accept? What do we believe? What do we hope for? So many conflicting things at the same time. Yeah.
And his actual passing, and I don't quite know how to word this question, and you can feel free not to answer it, but did you find yourself relieved in a way, in the sense of knowing his faith and knowing where he was going to go, and obviously the healing that is received, you know, in that moment of going to be with Jesus? Was that a relief to you? And if so, like, how did that then play with the obvious grief that I'm sure you were encountering in that moment as well?
So my dad died 6 weeks after coming to the UK. So he was getting to a point in his illness where they could no longer look after him safely where he was in Singapore. He left it right till the last minute to move over to the UK, where they have the kind of medical expertise to assist him. He came over, he was flying over the weekend that I went into labor. I went into labor with my first child then. It was a traumatic experience. I nearly died. She nearly died. My dad is dying. It was an extremely fraught moment in our collective life as a family. Very, very interesting time as well in terms of what the heck is going on. Right. And I really felt at that point, as I was in the labor room and I had the alarms going off and multiple medical staff running in, and this is my first baby, I have no idea what's going on. And the realization dawned on me, I may not have a living baby. And at that point, I just kind of had to fall back into God, really. Mm-hmm. And just that sense of, Lord, I cannot do anything. You have to do it. And I didn't even know what I wanted him to do. You know, I didn't even know what I was praying for. All I knew was that absolute failing on my part to be able to participate in anything whatsoever.
Right.
I have, my power of prayer is no, like, if I have really fancy words, they're no use here. If I conjure up faith, it's no use here. It really is beyond me. And so I think in that moment, that was kind of, this was like the perfect storm, isn't it? You've got my dad coming over, you've got my mum and my brother bringing him over, you've got me in the hospital, you know, fighting for our lives, really. And then my dad arrives, and we meet him 2 weeks later. And I have a tiny baby. She's 2.2 kilos at 40 weeks. Wow. But she's alive. and she's thriving. And she gets to meet her grandfather. And we go to where they're staying. And at this point, he's completely bedridden. He can barely open his mouth.
Right.
But yet he's able to meet his granddaughter. And I was able to be in his presence, be with him.
Yeah.
So that was a precious time, but it was a really fraught time. So yes, of course there was some relief to the end of his suffering. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's also that kind of pride that I have that he lived his life so well.
Right. Yeah.
Would I take that over having him here with us today? I don't know.
Mm.
I think what we found is there's been a change to our lives, a deep and profound change to our lives without him here that I never could have imagined. And yet it's new. It's a new, completely new life that we never would have predicted. And there is a joy to that as well. So yes, there was relief that he's gone and a deep, deep sadness that he's gone. But there is also the embrace and wonder at how God can make everything new in the aftermath.
Well, and this is something that I think is so central to what this podcast is all about. And something that I see as a thread through your story is this tension and this amazing grace that I think God gives us in humanity, where we experience, you know, intense pain and suffering and hurt and grief. And yet alongside of that, there's new life. You know, amazing that your daughter is born at around about that same period. You know, the sense of release and yet the sense of grief. And I know that this is something that, you know, you've mentioned in our time together today, just how much your dad was a creative person, but, you know, you're an incredibly creative person. You've certainly received that gene from both your dad and your mom, actually. And you're a musician yourself. And I remember back in the early days, you and I would share poetry together. I mean, there's always been this creativity of words and metaphor and beauty. And I know that beauty is something that you've reflected a lot on. And in particular, the relationship between beauty and suffering. And I think I see that, you know, in the process of your father passing. And I think, you know, that has had perhaps that's deepened perhaps your own reflections. So I wanted to just pick up on that sort of thought around beauty and suffering. What is it about beauty that you kind of hold on to in your faith? Why is beauty important, you know, particularly, I guess, in this time and in this moment of the world in which we're in? And what is it about how God uses beauty, do you think, you know, in the midst of our suffering? Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a theme I've been exploring, particularly as I kind of delving deeper into official ministry and preparations for being a priest. And incidentally, I don't think I'd be taking this road if it hadn't been for the death of my dad. So that's interesting too. So beauty is, I have had so many. Since my dad died, since my grandmother died, actually, we have had significant and profound instances of sadness and tragedy mm-hmm. in our lives and in the lives of our close, dear friends. And this is regular. It's a regular occurrence.
Right.
And perhaps it's just what it means to be a grown-up person. But I feel like every few months there's a significant difficulty that somebody I know and love, if not our own family, are going through.
Mm-hmm.
And Basil the Great talks about the great battle of life. And I think this is our experience as Christians, is that we are tender to the suffering of people around us. And I never want to become callous to that. I always want to be aware of that. And I want to experience the grief of that and go through that. In the security that God, that Jesus suffers with us, and kind mm-hmm. of we're not doing it alone. And I was thinking about a particular moment where a good friend of mine had a terrible tragedy, And I just wanted to give her something beautiful. And that was just like coming out of me. It was like, I just wanted to give her something so beautiful. And I didn't know what to do, but I was just finding, and I went to a shop and I found the most beautiful card I could find. And it felt so petty, but it was the best I could do.
Right.
And I was just reflecting on, you know, we give flowers, we give cards, we look for things that are soothing somehow when people experience grief. And it put me in mind of the verse where it says, and I'll give you beauty for ashes. And I was thinking, okay, so this idea of things being wrecked and yet God will give you beauty in place of that wreckage is established in the Bible. So what is that all about? And as a philosophy teacher, you know, you never get away from the question of suffering.
Right.
But for me, and I think, you know, we never should, we should always engage with it, because what it says to us is about our collective humanity. When we look at things, we say it is wrong that a man of 61 who has so much to give to the world has died. It's wrong that this child has now got a brain tumor. And we all agree that these things are wrong. And that's a collective agreement amongst us that suffering is wrong. Suffering is not as things should be. And kind of the glory of that is, well, it points to the fact that things should be otherwise. And why do we have that idea? Why do we have that collective sense that things should be different? Is it because there's something of God speaking in that about how he wants our world to be, how things could be? So there's that.
That is awesome. Because I think for me, like, I think this reality of, and we'll come back to what you're just about to say, because I want to hear it. But this beautiful reality of how there is something of, I think, art that is embedded into the depths of our humanity. Like, I think God being this creator creates us to be creative. And so in our expression of beauty, whether that's in song, in poetry, in art, in being a good father or mother, in being the best, you know, I don't know, like gardener you can be, or whatever it is, you know, like whatever it is that God has gifted you with, and you pour your life and your soul into that, there's artistic expression in that. And people are always at their best when they're, I think, digging into the beauty that is within them, that you know, I see as God's implantment into them of something of his own creativity. And maybe that's kind of part of what you're saying, is this, like, you know, we all know that suffering is wrong, and we all yearn for something else, and that yearning is actually there. And maybe the work of the artist is to bring people's attention to the beauty that is already there. Because I think so easily we lose that beauty in the suffering. The suffering speaks so much louder to us than the beauty. But so the work of the spirit, perhaps, is to awaken us to beauty. And I think that's why art and artists and creators are the bedrock of releasing new life into church contexts. And I think it's a travesty that, you know, in the global church, we've actually kind of pushed art out and not made it as central as perhaps it was earlier in our history. Sorry, that's a long comment, but that's just something that I'm kind of...
Yeah. I actually did a thesis on this for my theology MA about the prophetic quality of art and how it's needed in the charismatic evangelical church. Maybe for another conversation.
That's awesome.
But
we'll come back to that in another episode. Definitely.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. I think. What would I say? Okay, I want to just say that I don't think beauty is the same as art. I think that, and I agree with you, Andrew, I think that there is a prophetic quality to artists and creatives that is needed in the church to point us to the different dimensions of God at work in our world. Absolutely, 100%. But I would say that beauty is not exclusive to those people that would call themselves artists. In fact, when I'm brushing the tangles out of my six-year-old's hair, this is Genesis 1 work. This is making order out of chaos, which is what I think beauty is. And that's why I think we long for it so much, particularly in moments of suffering, because what it is the ordering of wreckage into something. It is the ordering, reordering of ourselves. And that's what I would say beauty is. And that's why I say I would totally agree with you. It is a work of the spirit that brings, that takes the ashes and gives us a crown of beauty. It forms something from destruction. So, yeah, so that's why I say, you know, so it's accessible for all of us, you know, whether you're doing the washing up or you're tidying up the living room or, as I say, brushing tangles out of somebody's hair. It's the Genesis 1 work of bringing order out of chaos. And that is the work of the Spirit. And that is the beautifying work of the Spirit in our lives. So that's what I would say about
it. I love that. And that is a fantastic way to draw this conversation to a close. I'm so grateful, honestly, Madeline, for, I mean, first of all, just opening up your story with your father. I know that's a very personal thing, and being willing to talk about it. Like we said earlier, that's, you know, these kinds of conversations are not perhaps embraced as much as they should be. And so thank you for being vulnerable on behalf of all the people that are listening. And yeah, just your reflections around that and the impact in your own faith journey, you know, the ideas of beauty and suffering and how those all come together. I think just such a helpful, I think theological reminder for people, but also something very practical for them to walk out in their own lives. And I know that many people listening are going through their own struggles and their own trials, and they're facing whatever it is that they're facing in their lives at the moment. And so that reminder to kind of join that Genesis 1 work, you know, of bringing order out of chaos is a beautiful thing. I'm sure some people may want to reach out to you, connect with you. What's a good way for people to stay in touch with you?
Yeah, you can, I'm on Instagram as Miller Mads. You can DM me there perhaps, or, you can find my contact details through the church that I work for, which is St. Albans Fulham, .org.uk. So you can go to the website and my email's there.
Well, thanks so much, Madeline, for opening up your story, for being so, honest and vulnerable with us. Thank you for joining into this conversation. I would love to get you back for that other conversation, which we'll have to do down the line. but grateful for your time today. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Andrew. Such a privilege. Lovely to be here today.
Well, that's pretty much episode 8 in the bag. Amazing, amazing conversation with Madeline, and just some of those reflections that she's brought on beauty in grief, about the Spirit's work of making order out of chaos. I just love that. And I know that will connect with a number of you who are going through some chaos in your own lives right now. And that great encouragement to be looking for and praying for the beauty to be found in the midst of that chaos. And just, you know, that is a work of the Spirit. And so my prayer for you is that you'll just really open yourselves to that work of the Spirit in the midst of whatever it is that you might be facing right now. So grateful for Madeline and for being willing to talk and share her journey, and obviously a real personal journey with her father, with us on the podcast. So thank you, Mads. And coming up in the next couple of weeks, we got some great podcasts. Episode 9 is a conversation I have with Andy Squires. He's a musician based in North Carolina who writes brutally honest and beautiful kind of faith-based reflections on journeying with God in hard times. So very suitable for this podcast. I can't wait for you to meet Andy. And then after that, I do an interview with Chelsea Wong. You may remember, if you've been with this podcast from the beginning, the very first episode was an episode with Josh Wong, her husband. And so we're following up that, celebrating episode 10 with a conversation with Chelsea and getting Chelsea's perspective on her husband's journey with cancer, and then of course the reality of his passing and her season of grief since his passing. So that's going to be an episode definitely to look out for. Thanks again for being with us today. I'll be praying for each one of us as we process what Madeline's been sharing with us, and do reach out and connect with me either on Instagram or on email if you want to just touch base and say hi. So God bless everyone.